This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2. It's already 10 after 1, so we've got a lot to fit into this program. A new novel by a well-known local author who suddenly is no longer local, but will be back here in a short time. That's Charles Entrekin, who was very prominent on the Nevada County literary scene, recently moved back to Berkeley, and then published his first novel, Red Mountain, which he'll be up here in just under 2 weeks to read from. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to talk about two of our most prominent writers who have just departed in a different way. One of them, Oakley Hall, very well known as a print writer. The other, Utah Phillips, best known as a singer and songwriter and storyteller, but also did some notable writing, not only of songs, but of poems and other things. And we're going to introduce a few of those which you might not be familiar with. But first, Charles Entrekin. Welcome to Booktown, Charles.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you.
So you got out of here and then immediately wrote a novel. That was not quite fair.
Well, actually, I wrote the novel while I was up there. I only got it published and then came down here to promote it.
And it's called Red Mountain. It's rather fascinating. Birmingham, Alabama, 1965, and has on the cover one of the strangest sculptures I've ever seen, something I never knew anything about, but which I guess plays a very prominent part in Birmingham life, or at least in the life of your character. What is this?
This is the second largest statue in the United States. It's a statue of Vulcan, who was considered by a lot of people to be the smithy of the gods, but he was also a darker figure. Certain religious cults, like the Gnostics, considered him a precursor to the devil, and he was also considered the god of cuckolds because his wife was always cheating on him.
But he has a very different function in Birmingham. He has a green light and a red light up on his... raised in his hand, is that
right? He sits on top of Red Mountain, overlooking the city of Birmingham, erected by the steel industry as a tribute to the steel industry. And he had, during all of my growing up, a big torch on the top of it. And when there was a fatality in downtown Birmingham, the light would glow red. And when no traffic fatalities occurred, it was green. That torch has subsequently been removed and has been replaced with a spear.
Okay. I won't go into that. Now, I don't want to say that this is an autobiographical novel. It may be totally unautobiographical, but it is a very personal one, a very harrowing one, about a young man experiencing just about everything in the way of personal relations you can in a very short couple of years in the late 50s and early 60s. And as I said, I won't go into whether it's autobiographical or not, but it is very intense, and I imagine it must have been rather difficult to write.
I actually first wrote this novel about 25 years ago, and then it took me about 3 years of 4 hours a day to rewrite it. That's a It was a long time, big effort for me, and it is semi-autobiographical, as I like to tell people. It's basically real events that have been shaped by fiction,
and it gives a, I would say, illuminating picture not only of the young man's life, but of the life of Birmingham, which I knew almost nothing about except that it was named after the English steel town because it was the steel center of the South. But I had no idea of its social structure, what went on there, or things like Red Mountain or the Statue of Vulcan. It was a very important time in the life of Birmingham because it was one of the centers of civil rights activity, both in the positive and negative sense, in the sense of great accomplishments and great disasters, like the church bombing that killed the four young girls. But strangely, the epigraphs to many of the chapters relate to the civil rights activity, but the characters, for the most part, don't really notice too much of what's going on.
No, they are the backdrop for the story, and the sort of the subtext of the book is you don't get to escape the effects of what's going on in your culture, even if you're not paying any attention.
Okay. And I know that Eddie, the character, inadvertently almost becomes part of one civil rights march, but leaves very quickly when they bring out the fire hoses. And he goes to one mixed racial meeting and decides he's not up to going any farther than that. You can sort of understand that because his personal life at this time is so intense. He was a young student. He got married at a very early age and then discovered how troubled his wife was and how difficult it was staying married to her.
There's a sense in which what this story is about is people who are coming into wakefulness about what's going on around them in their own lives and as well as in the culture around them. And as they wake up and have to face the demons that are there, there's a price to be paid for that. And the quote of the front of the book is from Nietzsche, who it says very well exactly what can happen to people who wake up in the middle of a culture and discover that their culture is got a really bad black side and dark side, and they have to try to stand up against it.
And sometimes they make it, and sometimes they don't.
Sometimes they make it, and sometimes they don't. Yeah, in a sense, the culture that was prevalent in Birmingham during the early 1960s has come back to the nation as a whole with the Bush administration, and a lot of the same kinds of wielding of power to make things happen, regardless of whether it's right or wrong, it was what was happening in Birmingham at the time.
You started writing it, or you wrote the first draft, you said 30 years ago?
Yeah.
And you rewrote it in the last few years. Did the new political climate affect how you worked on it?
No. Once I started rewriting it, I found that I just disappeared back into, it was like a time warp. I found myself reliving all of those events in time. My wife, Gail, said... it was really hard to live with me because when I would come back from my day at the office of working on this book, I had this faraway look in my eyes, and she felt like I wasn't present anymore. I was someplace else. Mm-hmm. I guess I was. I was back time traveling.
So you spent 4 years reworking something you'd written 30 years ago. What sort of changes did you make?
The first version was written in a kind of white-hot remembering of the event in which I didn't try to exercise any much control over the language or anything else. I just wrote it without stopping. And in the rewrite, I decided to add structure. I did research. I made an outline. I developed character profiles, and then sat down and tried to pull it all back together with the arc of the fiction.
Now, the characters, did you change characters from what you originally had?
No, not really. I changed names. I added added from my own imagination motivations for why things were happening. I just, when I was telling this story from in the white-hot moments, I was not paying any attention to what the story could be about. But once I started rewriting it, then I began adding all this structure, and then I could see, this must have happened because of this. And so I imagined, well, okay, if this must have happened because of that, then that probably was preceded by this. And so I could structure in my own mind what must have happened, which, of course, is all made up.
So much of what happens to the characters in the book, so much of the worst misunderstandings and then the horrible conclusion really depend on misunderstanding. And, well, I just said misunderstandings depend on misunderstanding, but depend in a sense on the way that the people in the novel were so sheltered from real emotions and from real human possibilities. They lived in most of them in a very, very narrow range, and when they tried to push out a little bit, the results were pretty horrible.
Yeah, exactly. A kind of motif of the book is if you don't have... There's the Alabama understanding, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And there is a huge politeness in the South that is comforting in a lot of ways, but it can be very repressive when you suddenly start confronting things that need to be talked about.
And the character, Eddie, the very first paragraph describes how much he had been shaken by the events of the 6 or 7 years involved in the novel and how he was now leaving Birmingham. Did you leave Birmingham before you started writing this?
Oh, yes.
You had to get away from it.
I had to get away from it. There's a long poem which I intend to read that starts off that first chapter, which is about my leave-taking, because I basically considered myself moving into an exile. I was abandoning my family and friends and just leaving the country, leaving my world behind.
Have you been back?
I go back periodically. I have brothers and sisters back there. My parents are now deceased, but my brothers and sisters all have thriving families, and I go back and visit with them from time to time.
Now, I always assumed, just from knowing you, that you had come from a somewhat literary family. I guess that's not the case.
No, my father and mother, neither one of them ever graduated from high school. So there were the only books in our family house was a set of encyclopedias that my father bought from a door-to-door salesman. I read them all. That was my reading matter for a long time. Was just reading the set of encyclopedias.
And Eddie's father comes close to disowning him when he announces that he wants to go to college.
Yeah, he thought that as I say in the book, he thought college was for the communists and for people who don't want to work for a living.
So, was it as hard for you as it was for Eddie?
Oh yeah. When I left home the last time, my father and I, we didn't speak for 5 years, 4 or 5 years. We if I If I went home, I always waited to make sure my father was not there.
So much of the, almost all of the action in the book takes place in Birmingham, but there is the crucial stretch moves to New York City, and then Eddie returns to Birmingham and finds himself almost completely alienated from family, friends, society, almost nothing of what he had been sort of comfortable in before holds any attraction for him anymore. But he does try to come to terms with things by going to work for Head Start, which again for his family is anathema, almost like a heresy. Did you experience anything like that?
Yeah, I was the only white male in the whole of Head Start for the state of Alabama, as far as I know. At least that's what I was told. It was quite an experience because I was not only shunned by my family for doing it, but I felt like at certain points I had taken my life in my hands to run around the city of Birmingham in the middle 60s with black children in tow. At some point I thought I would write about what it was like to teach in Head Start, but I finally decided to cut those chapters out.
Now, most people in Nevada County know you primarily as a poet rather than a novelist, but if you did start writing this sometime in the 70s, was that your original inclination toward fiction?
It was. It was. I thought I would write a novel. I thought I would become a writer and a teacher of literature and philosophy, and I had been accepted to UC Berkeley as a graduate student on a TA, and then Reagan slashed the budget. Mm-hmm. I lost my TA. I had a four-year-old child to provide for, and suddenly I was out on the streets. With no place to go but find a job.
Out on the streets in California?
In California. I had arrived in California with a teaching assistantship, I thought, and at UC. And when the teaching assistantship was taken away, I had no income. So I had to drop out of college and go to work.
What'd you do?
That's how I got into computers. And I started out as a trainee for Pac Bell in computer science.
And that's been what's supported you for most of your life so that you could do what you really want to do, which is writing, I assume.
Exactly, yeah. In some ways it was a interesting thing to do because my intention was to become a professor, and instead I became an entrepreneur. I started and sold three different computer companies now.
But you would probably intended to become a professor of philosophy?
Yes, I did.
Well, that's interesting. I had the same thought about the same time. I gave it up a little earlier than you did, and I'm glad I did. Do you have any regrets?
Well, there's something about the life of the mind that I wanted to pursue. There was things I wanted to study. I still sort of hanker after them every once in a while. I think I would have loved to have gone and studied under John Searle at UC. I think he's a marvelous professor, and I was really anxious to study his ideas about ordinary language philosophy. But I'm content with my lot. I've actually become, you know, quite financially successful, and now I'm able to turn my attention back to my writing. I probably would have never been able to do so if I'd stayed with teaching.
You moved to Berkeley. You moved out of Nevada County largely for health reasons, I believe.
Yes, I've been diagnosed with CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and I'm going to UCSF quarterly now for checkups, and so I decided I probably needed to be closer to where I'm going to be getting my chemotherapy treatments.
But you will be up here in 2 weeks, a little under 2 weeks, to present your new novel. Do you have other plans to come back to Nevada County?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like, you know, it's so funny with passing of Oakley Hall and Utah Phillips. I was friends with both of them, and I feel this great sadness. It's sort of like, I don't know how to put it exactly, but it felt like I've lost two strong father figures I didn't know them that well, but I spent time with them enough to feel really attached to them.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Charles Entrigan about his new novel, Red Mountain, subtitled Birmingham, Alabama, 1965. He'll be up here in just under 2 weeks on the 8th of June. That's a Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Off-Center Stage in Grass Valley. That's right behind the Center for the Arts. And you can get more information about that at 271-7000. So what are your other, do you have other writing projects in mind? Other fiction, or are you going to move back to poetry?
No, my intention is once we get settled here and I sort of get a sense of what my limits and liabilities are, that I have two more novels I want to write. I've been married three times and have three sets of kids. This novel really is really about my first wife, and I'd like to write a novel around my second marriage and a novel around my third marriage.
Wow. Does Gail know this?
Yes, she does. she's been quite encouraging, although I think a little bit nervous about it, because it's hard to predict what's going to come out once it starts happening. But once I got to Berkeley, I started founded the Berkeley Poets Co-op. I was thinking, you know, this is a historical period in Berkeley that deserves some sort of treatment, some sort of historical fiction understanding of what was going on as a result of the free speech movement, when such things like the Berkeley Poets Cooperative could get started and we could have a run of printing 30 different magazines and promote a lot of people who've gone on to become very successful poets and writers.
And my guess is that you were much more involved in the social changes in Berkeley than you had been in Birmingham.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I was nominated by the Bay Guardian as one of Berkeley's nifty 50 people.
Hmm.
One of the people who was highly influential in the cultural life of Berkeley during that period.
And you were highly influential in the cultural life of Nevada County in the last decade or so, and we'll be glad to see you back, if only for a short time.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I have so many friends, so many really good people. Nevada County is rich with really exciting, talented, beautiful people. I'm happy to have had my chance to know them.
So once again, Charles Entrigan will be here to present his new novel, Red Mountain, on Sunday, the 8th of June at 4 p.m. at the Off-Center Stage in Grass Valley. You can get more information at 271-7100. Thanks so much for being with us, Charles.
All right. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Thank you. This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 p.m. Most people in this listening area probably know of two crucial deaths, I guess if you can speak of a death as being crucial, two huge gaps left in Nevada County cultural life in the last 2 weeks. Just 2 weeks ago today, novelist Oakley Hall, who's had an immense influence in California writing over the last 40, 50 years, but has only really been living in Nevada County for a few years. His family has been here long before that, many members of his family. Anyway, he died almost exactly 2 weeks ago. And I have with me a person who I will always have to say comes on Booktown more than any other person ever, and there's always a good reason for it. This is one of the reasons I would have less liked to have had happen, but I'm still glad to welcome Professor Sands Hall. She's just informed me that I have to call her professor from now on. Hi, Sands.
Hello there.
Now, unfortunately, you're going to be leaving us too, but for a very short time, I guess.
Yes, just a year. I have a wonderful job as visiting professor of creative writing at a small liberal arts college in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, called Franklin and Marshall, and I'll be there from August through June of next year.
Sounds wonderful, and we'll be glad to see you come back. Unfortunately, we can't see your father come back.
No.
We do have a part of a conversation that was taped earlier this year at UC Berkeley. I'm going to play a little bit of that later on. I feel grateful that we had a short amount of time in Nevada County when we could get to appreciate him. Last fall's Wordslinger event with Oakley Hall the Man and Oakley Hall the Band was quite a wingding. And that was just before that was actually the first time I had really talked to him in a personal way. I'd met him in lines once or twice. And he was a fascinating person in addition to being a wonderful writer. And a very relaxed, very homey, and unpretentious and also totally irreverent.
That's right.
That's the impression I had.
A wonderful description of him, yeah. And I think that especially the opportunity for that band and the man to come together so close to the end of his life was a really, really special situation. Just wonderful. I'm so glad that he was really not looking forward to that event, and it turned out just to be he was so grateful that it was pulled together, and I'm grateful to Literature Live and to the lovely community we have for turning out for such an odd and eclectic and absolutely delightful event.
Why wasn't he looking forward to it?
Well, he has always eschewed attention, and yet at the same time, I think especially I can imagine getting towards the end of your life and knowing you have this humongous body of work behind you and a band that's chosen to name itself after your name, and that there is something lovely about being acknowledged and celebrated. And in fact, I was very conscious he was ill for 2 years, and so the death is certainly difficult but not unexpected. But I think the saddest part is that he hasn't seen the huge outpouring of obituaries in the New York Times and the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle and small papers all over the United States. Friends have written me from Boise and from Fort Townsend to say that there were obits in their papers, and I just think that kind of thing would just have both galled him and delighted him in equal measure.
And it's sort of strange that he wrote so many genres, so many styles over such a long period, starting with mystery stories, writing a couple of things that are sort of known as westerns, writing straight fiction as well, and then ending up with this Ambrose Bierce mystery series. But the one big Gibraltar that stands in the middle of it all is the novel Warlock.
Indeed.
And I sometimes think he may be somewhat resent that one novel because everyone reads that and doesn't have time to pay attention to some of the others.
I think that's a good point, Eric. I think especially he had great, I think, ambitions for his final novel, Love and War in California. And indeed, it's a wonderful book. It's a big saga of California and talks about sort of, as Dad often said, he just got pissed off about things and wanted to write about them, which is where the Ambrose series came from. And Love and War is full of those kinds of wrongs that starts in World War II and takes in the Depression and what was happening with the Dust Bowl and even issues of abortion. And he was very irate often at the way things were wrong and how they could be righted. And that book, last book, Love and War in California, really tried to lay that out in as close a character to himself as I think he ever put on paper. I'm very glad he was alive to go on a book tour and have such a, have it be celebrated as much as it was. But I think he was hoping it would get up there with Warlock, which it's true. It's the only one that was nominated for a Pulitzer and really has. And there's really good reason. You know, I'm sure many of the listeners have watched Deadwood, and so many people who read Warlock just thought Deadwood had almost been pulled completely from it. And it's true that so many of the elements, if you were to read Warlock and watch Deadwood side by side, you would almost think that one was adapted from the other. They are so close. And he had such a sort of marvelous sense of no white hats, black hats, Western, but a much more morally complicated view of the world. And I view that book as a fantastic exploration of why civilization will demand order and why we have to have law to keep order in place. And it's both dismal and necessary, these aspects. And I think that book just does a beautiful job and a heart-rending job and an extremely exciting job of putting that on paper.
Now, he actually wrote three Westerns in all, and there was another one, The Badlands, and I thought that was the one that, I haven't read it, I must admit, because I was reading Warlock, but I thought that was the one on which a lot of Deadwood was based as well.
Absolutely good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I can see why you would think so.
We have one of the other fortunate things about your father's life was that just in the last year, the University of California has begun what they call their Story Hour series at a library on the Berkeley campus. And the very first one in January was a conversation between Oakley Hall and Michael Chabon. And we should say that in addition to being a fantastic writer, your father was a very influential teacher, both at UC Irvine and then at the Squaw Valley community of writers, which he helped found. And this conversation goes on for quite a ways. I think I might just play about 4 minutes of it, which I think will interest you greatly. And then we might talk a little bit more after that. But Michael Chabon, who I think was now considered Berkeley's best known and most outrageous writer, was a student of Oakley Hall's, and these are some of the things he has to say about his teacher. I should warn you that for such a well-endowed institution, the Story Hour only had one microphone, and they were passing it back and forth, so some of the passages are a little garbled, but I think you can get the drift.
Hi, thank you all so much for coming. I, of course, agreed to do this. I jumped at the chance. At the end of Charlotte's Web, there's that famous passage about what a rare thing it is to find someone who's both a good writer and a good friend. It's probably equally rare to find someone who's both a good writer and a good teacher. And Oakley Hall is both, and he means so much to me as a writer, as a teacher, and as a friend. I was in the MFA program at Irvine. I guess before I get personal, I just want to say so many of Oakley's books mean so much to me. Children of the Sun, I love the Ambrose Bierce detective novels, the Corpus of Joe Bailey, and then his most recent novel that is in many ways kind of a bookend to Corpus of Joe Bailey, Love and War in California. They're all wonderful books, but Warlock, if you haven't ever read Warlock by Oakley Hall, you're just really depriving yourself of one of the great privileges you can have and pleasures you can have as a reader.
I was told the margins aren't wide enough.
The margins aren't wide enough? Well, I didn't bring my ruler again, so I can't really measure them, but I don't remember noticing that. If you want to see not only what the Western novel is capable of, but what the American novel is capable of. And also, if anybody here was fond of the television program Deadwood, and you want to see where they stole all the everything from, especially the way the characters speak to one another, just check out Warlock. It's such a wonderful novel. All I wanted to say about Oakley as a teacher is that when I showed up at UC Irvine in 1985, I had begun work on a novel. I was under the impression that you had to be writing a novel if you were in graduate school in fiction writing. And it seemed to me, I went down for a visit to check it out down there, and it seemed to me that everybody was writing a novel. So I started a novel, and I showed up. I had 110 pages of it when I started in the fall, and Oakley asked if he could read them, and I gave them to Oakley to read, and he summoned me into his office, and he Well, he was gentle, but he was not unsparing, let's say. And when he sent me away after having told me that I had far too many characters and no story and nothing was happening and there was not enough danger and it was 110 pages, and when was I going to get down to it already? So he sent me back to the drawing board, and I cut all but about 15 pages, and essentially started all over again with a much clearer sense of telling a story, that was my job.
Published it.
Well, and what I want to say is then after that, so he was completely and utterly responsible for what the novel became. And then after it came out, somebody interviewed him, asked him about Mysteries of Pittsburgh, and he went on record saying that nobody could tell me anything, and that I had, you know, refused to listen to all the yeah, you did. So, I think it was very kind of you, because the way I interpret it is what you were saying was somehow I just was born fully grown, and.
For you would get out of your way.
Exactly. And that was just so not true. You were so in my way, and it was so completely useful and instructive and important, and I got so much out of your being in my way, and I'm so eternally grateful for that. So that's all I want to say. I wanted to just start out by asking you about the fact that your first novel, your first two novels, were both hard-boiled detectives.
We could go on a lot longer. They talk for about another 10 minutes, but I think you get a good feeling not only of how Oakley Hall helped Michael Chabon, but also of the very strong affection between the two, which is probably the very best kind of working relationship you can have.
I think living, visiting them periodically, my parents periodically, and just being around my parents, of course, going along with my own life, I was struck constantly by how his students stayed in touch and the incredible degree of affection, and he just was hugely beloved by his students, in spite of, I think sometimes rather, I know as my own critic at times, it was really hard to hear from him sometimes, and I think that Michael puts that out very gently and well, how a hard dad could be, but also very thorough and useful, often comments that made you writhe, but made you go back to the drawing board with a better sense of what you needed to do.
And his children turned out very literary. You've written plays, novels, nonfiction. Your brother is a playwright. Your brother-in-law is a novelist. Was this inevitable?
For a long time, I did not think of myself as a writer at all. I think partly because maybe I just felt Oakley took up the oxygen in that particular tank. I don't know. But I guess I always have written in journals and wanted to somehow be, I suppose I went into theater, and so did my brother to some degree, as another mode. But at a certain point, I realized this is what I do, and I do want to do it. And I think one of the great pleasures of my life is that towards the end we got to be such good friends, both as teachers and as fellow writers, and what an incredible pleasure it was to toss big ideas back and forth and to argue and to really not see eye to eye often about certain things, but in the long run the basic stuff was always in place. And I'm a very different kind of teacher than he ever was. I'm an extremely different kind of writer, but I know those influences and mentorship were huge.
Are you working on another novel yourself?
My current one's in New York, being bandied about, and I have not really had time to work on a novel. I have some ideas in the back of my head, but right now it's pretty much getting ready to teach is what I'll be doing for the next
few
months.
Your second one is finished and is going
finished.
Through the mill.
I'm hugely proud of it. We'll see what happens.
How did he help at all?
No, in that particular case, I really kept it off his plate. We were, he had some problems. The narrator was a certain kind of person like he just didn't really have a lot of affection for. So we just determined that we would, although having read it, he said there's some great writing in here, but we just determined on that particular front too. And I have to say, that's a loss to me that I didn't sort of push through that particular one and have him read it all the way through. He read the first half and had lots to say that was positive, a couple of comments that were hard to hear but useful, and but he didn't get to read the second half.
And by then it was too late, it was already gone.
Yeah, well, I just, at any point I could have printed it out, but I just determined, nah. And he wasn't, he said something very interesting, and rather often in the last couple of years, he wasn't really interested in fiction anymore. He wanted to read nonfiction, and he wanted to read history, and in fact, he wrote another book, which he had rewritten just before he passed away, which is a kind of reshaping of the Lancelot, Guinevere, and Arthur legend, with Guinevere as a sort of force of a new morality in the world. A very interesting take on the story.
And it's interesting that one of the last things you said he read was Charles Entrecken's Red Mountain.
That's right. And he said with such pleasure how much he had enjoyed it. We had a couple of nice chats about that, actually. It was really fun.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I've been talking with Sands Hall about her father, Oakley Hall, who died 2 weeks ago. And we could finish the hour talking about this, but I do want to get to Utah Phillips as well, as a writer, not just a songwriter and not just a storyteller, but a writer of a very different sort than you might have imagined. Anyway, thanks for being with us, Sands, and I'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you so much, Eric.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome. A message from CAL FIRE. They're saying that a grass fire near Highway 49 and Lawrence and just north of Jager Road and, north of Jager Road and north of Auburn has been contained. The initial reports of the fire at 1 to 2 acres. Again, a grass fire near Highway 49 and Lawrence and north of Auburn has been contained. There's not much time to say as much as I might want to about Utah Phillips. There's been a lot on KVMR already last night. This morning there was a 2-hour tribute on Steve Baker's morning show. I think there's going to be more this evening at 6, a rebroadcast of an earlier tribute to him. I'd like to just touch on him in an aspect that other people might not know as well. If you ever look through his first, actually his only songbook, Starlight on the Rails, which was written in 1973, it's got almost 100 pages of songs, and some of them are labor songs, some of them are traditional songs that he reworked, a lot of them are his own, but there are a few songs that are very different from the more, I guess you could say, strident ones he's best known for. There's ones called I Think of You, and the one that's my very favorite, If I Could Be the Rain. He says about it, "Everybody I know sings this song their own way, and they arrive at their own understanding of it. Guy Carawan does it as a sing-along. I guess he thinks it must have some kind of universal appeal. To me, it's a very personal song. It's about events in my life that have to do with being in love. I very seldom sing it myself for those reasons." And I think that there really were two sides to the man, the very tender and the very gruff, and he tended to play up the gruff side and de-emphasize the tender side in many ways. And this particular song, which I think is probably the greatest American song of the last half century, has hardly ever been recorded. Rosalie Sorrells did it twice, once on an early album called If I Could Be the Rain, which has two or three of Utah's other songs as well. And then she did it more recently in a jazzier version with three or four instrumentalists, which I think is absolutely horrible, and I can barely listen to. I barely recognize it as the same song. And I'm going to go out in a couple of minutes with If I Could Be the Rain. Before that, though, I'd like to touch on a few of his poems he wrote. He wrote a book called The Old Guy in 1988. And some of these are very personal. Some of them are very funny. The one called He Plays, I was tempted to read, but I think I'm partly a character in it, so I'm going to leave that out. And I'll read another one of his more personal ones from The Old Guy called The Old Guy Gets Cracked. She is a crack in time, the dull ticking of inevitability cracked. I am going toward a crack in time to be with her, cracked. She is a crack in my time, a solid poke that makes me start. She pokes and says, "See here." I look into this crack in my time and see her. I do a lot more than just fly to get here. I'd walk, climb, paddle, roll, whatever needed doing to get me into that crack in my time where she looks out. I know that her secret hand has touched some part of me that never got touched before, and that it was the part that needed touching the most. And because of it, this crack in my time opened up, and now I can flow through it and wrap myself warm around this spirit life and feel that secret hand again. I feel it now. When I get there, I promise to be still. I hope she'll stand and look at me for a long time and see that I am good and cracked. I have made a lot of mistakes. This is not one of them. That was a poem by Utah Phillips from The Old Guy Poems. I couldn't find my copy this morning. I was looking around desperately, went online to see if they were available. I discovered that Amazon has them starting at $85. So if you have one of these, hold on to it. It might put your grandchildren through college. But in any case, it's a just lovely little book, and as I said, gives you a very different view of Utah Phillips than the person you hear about, whose songs you hear about, whose jokes you hear, whose political activism you hear. This is the tender side. I think the activist side would never probably have occurred without this tender side. And I hope that as time goes on, more and more people will recognize it. And now, what I think, he was asked if he had favorite songs, and he said they were Walter Houston singing September Song and the Carter Family singing Jim Blake's Message. I don't know Jim Blake's Message, but I think If I Could Be the Rain might be the greatest American song since September Song. There, I waited it down.
Sometimes I wonder how the simple rain can weep. Why the wind's a lonely child that cries itself to sleep. I've envied the sunlight, the amber of its smile. Wished it could be borrowed for a while. If I could be the rain, I'd wash down to the sea. If I could be the wind, there'd be no more of me. If I could be the sunlight and all the days were mine, I would find some special place to shine. Thank you. sometimes I wish that I could be the rain. If I could be the rain, I'd wash down to the sea. If I could be the wind, there'd be no more of me. If I could hide the way I feel, I'd never sing again. Sometimes I wish that I could be the rain. Sometimes I wish that I could be the rain.